Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with an analyst about Tunisia's Nobel Peace Prize win. The Democratic U.S. presidential candidates gear up for their first debate. A doctor shares with us his finding that there is a correlation between habits and success.
Your glass might be full of a bunch of toxic junk, and we can look at it or ignore it, treat it, or the approach I take is to just select some new good habits.
And some members of the famous music group The Grateful Dead are rising again to perform. It's right here on The Voice of America. The 2015 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet for its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the revolution of 2011. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke to Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, about what that means for Tunisia and what kind of lessons it offers to other Arab Spring countries. Welcome, Mohamed, to the studio.
Thank you.
Say, Mohamed, the committee notes that Tunisia shows that civil society institutions and organizations can play a crucial role in a country's democratization, even under difficult circumstances.
That's why Tunisians have felt that this award was given not only to the four leading civil society organizations, but also to the entire population, because they feel it was a collective effort that led to a national dialogue which managed to bring all sides together. And that international recognition is offering a good lesson for the other Arab Spring countries, as Masmoudi explains.
Instead of fighting, instead of every side or each side trying to govern alone and trying to exclude the others from the political process, and which of course is what we have seen in other countries of the Arab Spring. There were four other countries, Libya, Egypt, Syria, and Yemen. Unfortunately, these four countries failed in uniting the country, in bringing all the parties together and uniting and building a united vision for the country. And this is what Tunisia shows. It shows that when Islamists and secularists and all the other parties together sit around the table, they can always find a compromise and common ground, and they can always succeed in finding a better alternative to violence or confrontation.
Masmoudi said political will is necessary but not sufficient to reach a consensus. That's why civil society organizations, with its trained facilitators, played a pivotal role and bridging the gaps between the political parties.
Mohamed, Libya is still unable to reach such a compromise, and Egypt is witnessing instability and political polarization. Might the Nobel Prize for Peace being awarded to Tunisia give some inspiration for those countries to emulate the Tunisian model?
Actually, yes. The Tunisian model serves as a ray of hope for the troubled transitions in the other Arab Spring countries. But if they wish to learn from that lesson, according to Masmoudi.
Every side has to compromise. Everybody has to put the interest of the nation above their own interests or above their own political interests. If everybody does that, if everybody looks at the Tunisian experience and why it succeeded, how the Islamists and the secularists were able to overcome their differences and to have a united vision. If we did it in Tunisia, if the Tunisian society was able to do it, surely people in Libya or in Egypt can do the same thing.
Well, thank you very much, Mohamed, for this insight.
Thank you, Sue.
Now joining me with today's social media report is Sarah Williams. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. Well, in other Nobel Prize news, there's been a lot of reaction to Princeton University professor Angus Deaton. Now, he's won the 2015 Nobel Prize for Economics. Reuters hailed his work on consumption, poverty, and welfare that it says has helped governments to improve policy through tools such as household surveys and tax changes. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said Monday that by linking detailed individual choices and aggregate outcomes, Deaton's research has helped transform the fields of microeconomics, macroeconomics, and development economics. In a press conference following the announcement, Deaton said he was delighted that his work had been recognized. The Scottish-born Deaton is a dual British and U.S. citizen, and he's been a professor of economics and international affairs at New Jersey's Princeton University since 1983. Well, in other top news, Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu is saying the Islamic State group is the top suspect in Saturday's double suicide bombing in Ankara that killed at least 97 people. Davutoğlu said authorities are close to identifying one of the bombers and that that evidence points to a certain group. Well, meanwhile, thousands of people gathered near the attack site at Ankara's main railway station on Monday. Reuters reports that opponents of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan are blaming him for increasing nationalist sentiment by campaigning against Kurdish separatists. Erdogan denies those charges. Well, and finally, Cecil the Lion. Zimbabwe's government says it will not file charges against U.S. dentist Walter Palmer, who killed the famed Cecil the Lion. Palmer admitted killing the prized black maned lion with a bow and arrow on July 1st near Zimbabwe's Hwanga National Park. Palmer said he hired professional local guides with the required hunting permits, and he believed the hunt was legal. The lion was a major attraction at the park and was being tracked with a GPS collar as part of an Oxford University research project. Charlene Marlin tweets that humans failed you, Cecil. I'm ashamed to be part of the human race. Pangash tweets, this is not about the legality of the kill. This is about the cruelty behind the act. And PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, tweets, animals are not trophies. Susan?
Thank you, Sarah. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Recently, the science world was all a-Twitter after NASA announced that its scientists found evidence of flowing water on Mars. The excitement raised the hopes of many that life might exist on the red planet. Researchers at Caltech studied data from NASA's Curiosity rover and are now saying that they have found evidence of lakes and streams on ancient Mars. They say 3.8 billion to 3.3 billion years ago, the red planet had a much more rich and robust atmosphere and a lively hydrosphere where water flowed and accumulated in lakes across its surface. The evidence suggesting a watery ancient Mars was found in sediment layers near the base of Mount Sharp, a 4.5 kilometer mountain rising from the center of the massive Gale Crater. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The five Democrats running for president of the United States will get their moment in the spotlight in the first Democratic candidates debate Tuesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. Our national correspondent Jim Malone joins us here in the studio to give us a bit of a preview. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. So the stakes are high in this public debate.
They are high. They're high for all of the candidates involved, particularly for Hillary Clinton, who's been leading the pack, for Bernie Sanders, the surprising surging candidate, the Vermont senator, who has done very well, especially in some early states that vote, like Iowa and particularly in New Hampshire, where he's leading Hillary Clinton at the moment. And also, there's three other candidates that are going to be in the debate. This is their moment to maybe break through. I'm talking about the former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, the former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, and the former Governor of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee.
Do you think there will be some tough questioning and talking, or might the candidates be a little easy on each other for the sake of the party in the long run? And after all, they just want to get the White House.
That's actually a good question, because what we've noticed so far is Bernie Sanders has done very well, but there have been no attacks from the Clinton campaign. That's by design. Mm-hmm. They don't want to alienate those Sanders supporters because she'd like to count on them later on, assuming that she becomes the nominee. So will we see a change in strategy in the debate by the Clinton camp, trying to draw more of a contrast with Bernie Sanders, who has described himself as a democratic socialist? And many people who go to his rallies are enthralled by the Sanders candidacy and his focus on the sort of income gap among Americans, the very wealthy and the rest of the population struggling. So it's going to be a test not only for Clinton, but for Sanders. Can he broaden his appeal? And, of course, for the other three in the debate, can they even get on the radar? Because right now the only people mattering who have announced are Clinton and Sanders.
And we have seen the Republicans really going after each other.
We have. You know, this is the first Democratic debate. We've already had a couple on the Republican side. That has had the effect of, shooting Donald Trump up to the top spot. But it's also scrambled the race because you have many other people jockeying for position in the Republican field. We have 15 total candidates. One day Jeb Bush is up. The next day he's down. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson are up. So there's quite a bit of uncertainty on the Republican side. There is uncertainty on the Democratic side, but the players are pretty well known for the moment, primarily Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Well, Clinton has been trying to clean up her image lately.
Yes, she's, of course, dealing with questions about her trustworthiness, particularly as it relates to how she comes across to voters, but also this controversy over her use of private email account while Secretary of State.
And I noticed she recently brought out the big gun, and that being her husband, the former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit more of him. I mean, I think for a long time she wanted to make it clear that she's running on her own. She said, I'm not running for a third Bill Clinton term. I'm running for my own first term. She's also said, I'm not running for a third Barack Obama term. And what we've seen of late is her putting some distance between herself and Barack Obama on things like Syria. She's arguing for a no-fly zone in Syria. She would take a more muscular approach in some foreign policy areas. So that may come out in the debate as well. So you could have Hillary Clinton not only drawing distinctions with Bernie Sanders, but with the current president of the United States and her one-time political rival going back to 2008.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for stopping by.
My pleasure.
Coming up on International Edition, tips to choosing your own path to success. And we might not have seen the last of the dead. Your daily habits may count for more than you think when it comes to being successful. Dr. Randall Bell has analyzed the results of a survey and finds there is a correlation between the two issues, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, how do habits and success relate?
Well, they relate absolutely in every way. We have no control over so many things. We have no control over the weather and global economics, and we have very limited control over others, just ask my kids. But we have total control. In fact, the only thing that we have total control is our habits, the time we get up, what we eat, what we put in our mouth, what we're thinking, who we choose to talk to, who we choose to get away from. Those are all daily choices and habits, rituals, and routines, and that all stacks up to who we eventually become.
Well, how can you get your habits to help you be successful?
Well, you need to identify exactly what habits you have that you want to keep that are productive and healthy, and what habits you want to get rid of. I do a lot of volunteer work with the homeless people, and we have a very high success rate of getting them sober off the street. And the people that I work with are very serious about the rehabilitation, and it all starts with their habits. Exactly what time you get up, what you're going to choose to eat, what you're going to choose to think, if you're going to go out to the beach and meditate or pray, if you're going to read a good book or a trashy book. These are all choices and habits, and we've got to identify which ones are really taking us in the direction we want to go and which ones are holding us back from where we want to be, and take total charge of the habits we allow into our life.
Well, beyond addiction or something very serious like that, for the average person, it's kind of difficult sometimes to change your habits. So you got any clues for us on how to get rid of the bad ones and get more good ones?
Absolutely. The philosophy that I use, and I use it with CEOs that are literally multimillionaires and even a few billionaires that I work with, and right down to the homeless, is something I call the full glass theory. And we only have 24 hours in a day. It doesn't matter who we are, where we're from. We all have 24 hours in a day. And my focus is to forget the bad habits. Really, just your glass might be full of a bunch of toxic junk, and we can look at it or ignore it, treat it. The approach I take is to just select some new good habits, just one or two, and start pouring in new good habits. And over time, those habits stack up, and it displaces the old habits automatically. In other words, If I've got a bad habit of being addicted to my internet late at night, browsing the internet, if I forget that habit, if I create a new habit of reading a book at night or something, or having a conversation with my kids or my wife, in replacement, I've automatically displaced the bad habit. So my emphasis is on good habits, and as we accumulate more and more good habits, the old bad ones are displaced.
Nice trick. Well, please tell us a little bit about your book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits.
Well, essentially, I've been working in the field of disaster recovery for 25, 30 years. I worked on the World Trade Center. I worked on JonBenet Ramsey and O.J. Simpson and the BP oil spill, a whole array of disasters. So I interweave a lot of my experiences, given the fact that I had a lot of unique access to interesting places and people over the last few decades. I interweave those stories with a sociological study I did as a sociologist, where I surveyed 5,000 people across the world, and I scientifically, with statistics, correlated daily habits to different measures of success. Of course, making money, but also maybe even more importantly, being happy, good relationships, levels of education. So that is interweaved throughout the book. And then I also go back to some of the basics. I have some classic sociological studies that are very fascinating, and it's all interweaved between in four sections: me, we, do, be. Me habits are habits that build our intellect, our mind. We habits are habits that build our relationships. Do habits improve our productivity with our space, with our health, with our money? And be habits are special habits because they're goal-oriented. They're towards creating our own personal legacy and habits that build that. So it's all broken. While there's a lot of information, a lot of interweaving between these interesting areas, it all comes under these four simple groups of me, we, do, be habits.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doctor, for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
If you thought you'd heard the last live performances from the iconic jam group, The Grateful Dead, think again. Three of the original group members are teaming with singer John Mayer for a tour called Dead and Company. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the tour came about when Mayer met some of the group members while hosting a talk show.
Last June and July in San Francisco and Chicago, the Grateful Dead played what were billed as their final concerts ever. The sold-out shows came two decades after guitarist and de facto group leader Jerry Garcia died of a heart attack. But now it appears that we might not have seen the last of the Dead. Group members Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann are teaming with guitarist and singer John Mayer for a new tour called Dead and Company. Mayer has been rehearsing with the group in San Rafael, California. He says the idea came from the way he and some Dead members meshed when he hosted the Late Late Show in February.
Bob and I played on that show and then started to play together up here. And before long, it revealed itself as something that was organic and musical and vital and made sense and really kind of tore down all of the labels and boundaries and stigmas for everybody. And that's what music is supposed to do in the first place. It becomes ultimate truth. Everything goes out the window, and it becomes ultimate truth when we start playing, you know.
Bob Weir says that when he and Mayer played together, there was a communication between the musicians that he wanted to see continue.
And I couldn't help but notice that John was listening to what I was playing. He had learned the songs. I expected that, but he was listening to what I was playing, and he was answering that. And it was fun. And it's just so more fun than, you know, that I was really going to be happy about just walking away from. So we got to talking, and stuff started rolling.
Percussionist Mickey Hart says that while the show is aimed at the band's diehard fans, the players also get something from performing together again.
Well, it's not just for the fans. It is for the fans, but it's for us, too. Remember, these songs are part of us, and we feel like we want to play them, and we think they're important enough to play. And as long as it feels good, and people want to listen to it and want to come to the concerts and bathe in that experience, you can't say no, nor should you.
And for those fans, some of whom paid thousands of dollars to the supposed final shows earlier this year, Mayer says he thinks that they will be glad the band is playing again, despite the cost.
I don't think there's anybody who bought a ticket to go to the Fare Thee Well shows and said, I hope this is really it. I just don't know of any deadhead in the world who said, I just, when I paid my money, I paid to see these guys finish this.
Right.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in. Keep trucking like the dude I'm made.
The band also announced that 5,000 fans will have the chance to win two tickets each to a free November 7th concert at Madison Square Garden in New York. Dead & Company begins its nationwide tour October 29th at the Times Union Center in Albany, New York. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In addition to ISIL's atrocities inflicted every day on the Iraqi and Syrian people living in communities the terrorist group has seized, the crucifixions, beheadings, sexual enslavement and violence, rape and denial of every human right, ISIL is also engaged in other crimes, including its attempt to erase cultural heritage that does not conform to its narrow ideology. ISIL's latest reported cultural destruction target is the Arch of Triumph in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, a monument thought to be 2,000 years old. It is now added to the list of ISIL's demolition of shrines or statues that predate the founding of Islam, like the Assyrian winged bulls in Nineveh, the historic lions in Raqqa, and the tomb of Jonah in Mosul. What ISIL doesn't destroy of Syria and Iraq's ancient history and heritage, it sells, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted recently at a symposium at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
These ancient coins, stone, glass, mosaic fragments, travel organized routes through black markets in the Middle East, Europe, and the Persian Gulf. The profits return to line the pockets of these extremists, funding more savagery, more terror, and more devastation.
It is for this reason the United States has developed red lists with the International Council of Museums to help law enforcement officials recognize looted objects. It's why the U.S. has stepped up efforts through the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL to encourage greater action against the illicit trade. It's why the United States works so closely with international law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and around the world. And it's why the United States recently announced that it is offering, through the State Department's Rewards for Justice program, up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or the trade of antiquities by, for, or on behalf of ISIL. calling the refusal to deal in conflict antiquities both a legal and moral obligation, Mr. Blinken said, in the face of the urgent challenges of today, it is critical that we hold fast to the fabric of our humanity, to our gifts of reason and wisdom, our expressions of art and culture, and our universal values of civility, freedom, and dignity. These are exactly what ISIL seeks to destroy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.